Google for the emails of James Rosen of Fox News, who, of course, he was leaked information allegedly by a federal employee who's now serving a prison sentence. But if you read what the government did to justify seizing all of James Rosen's Gmail, not his Fox News account, his Gmail, it's incredible. They basically said, and they knew that this wasn't true, that James Rosen is basically in a conspiracy to commit a very, very serious crime, and we need to get all of his emails. Now, James Rosen was also an imbecile in how he dealt with his source, and that's clear in that subpoena and that warrant. Read that warrant. It's chilling for press freedom.
We're going to have to leave it there. Jeremy Scahill with The Intercept and Alex Sinha, the author of The Port, with Liberty to Monitor All, How Large-Scale U.S. Surveillance is Harming Journalism, Law, and American Democracy. He's at the ACLU and Human Rights Watch. That does it for our broadcast. We have a job opening here at Democracy Now, an on-air graphic designer and CG operator. Visit democracynow.org for information. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Malkoff, Honey Masood, Rabbi Karen, Dina Guster, Amy Littlefield. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Elizabeth Press, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira. I'm Amy Goodman with Aaron Maté. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, NSA. I just called you to say I love you because you really listen. Now when I'm on the phone, will I never feel alone? 'Cause you're out there with your headphones and you really listen. I know you'll take my call, 'cause you care enough to take them all, and you're fighting freedom here at home, so we don't have to fight it over there. Now my own sweet Marie never listens to me. I can't even get through to my mama, but you listen so well to the secrets I tell. Guess that's how Obama caught Osama. NSA, listen please while I order extra cheese. I love you, 'cause you're out there. Here's how I know. Not a stain on a dress, but a leak nonetheless tells me so.
The news is bad. Untold scores of traumatized children fleeing the violence engulfing their homes. The U.S. government and your tax dollars fueling the flames. Am I talking about Honduras, Gaza, Syria, or Iraq? No, I'm talking about our longest-running war, our 9/11 bomb 'em back to the Stone Ages war, Afghanistan. A human crisis of nearly incomprehensible proportions continues to unfold while other crises grab the headlines. Join me, Linda Olson Osterlin, for Wednesday Talk Radio. Call in and talk with guest Professor Zahair Wahab, just back from Kabul. Ask your questions and share your point of view on America's longest war. That's Wednesday Talk Radio with guest Professor Zahair Wahab, right here on KBOO Community Radio.
And you are tuned in to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 5:04. Stay tuned for the evening news.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Gaza overnight, killing Israeli forces launch hundreds of bombs into Gaza overnight, killing 100 Palestinians and destroying government ministry buildings, media offices, and the only power plant in Gaza.
Consumer groups in the U.S. claim a victory on food labeling.
And the U.S. House votes to gut the protections provided by the Endangered Species Act.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 29th, 2014. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. In a push to achieve public support for an increase in taxes, Portland Commissioner Steve Novick and Portland Mayor Charlie Hales met Monday afternoon to discuss the proposed Portland street fee to help fund road safety and maintenance. Monday's meeting with city officials also included a group of businessmen and women who were not completely sold on the idea of being charged what is estimated to be $50 million a year to increase the funding by street fees. The project would increase taxes for all residences regardless of income brackets, but critics are especially concerned for residents who cannot afford the added tax at $12 a month. Less than 4 months before, Commissioner Novick and Mayor Charlie Hales plan to return to their city council colleagues with a specific plan to pay for road safety and maintenance projects. Officials have yet to win over the business community. Plans for the next meeting are scheduled for August 11th. Another work group representing low-income residents and nonprofits group met Tuesday at 3:30 p.m. at the Portland building. An update on that meeting will be given on the Wednesday evening news.
The U.S. House of Representatives today passed a measure that will essentially gut the Endangered Species Act. The bill now moves to the Senate for approval. Representative Peter DeFazio of Oregon gave a strong statement on why it is important to preserve the Endangered Species Act as it is.
I rise today just before Congress goes on a five-week recess for the entire month of August and the first week of September. And during that time, we will celebrate Labor Day. Now, there's a lot of reasons to celebrate Labor Day, but it has particular context to this debate today. 100 years ago, this Labor Day, Martha died. Now, perhaps not everybody here knows about or has heard about Martha. Martha was the last passenger pigeon. Died in the Cincinnati Zoo. Now, none of us remember passenger pigeons, but they were in numbers so great, billions, that they would darken the sky for hours or days as they passed. Yet, within a very short period of time, they became extinct. I believe she is stuffed and on display at the Smithsonian. I think they have a special exhibit on this I'd recommend to people to remember the way things used to be. Now, we did then, 50 years later, pass the Endangered Species Act. So this is kind of symmetrical. 100 years ago, last passenger pigeon. 50 years later, we adopt a law to try and preserve species. And, you know, I think the most eloquent words I've ever heard on an endangered species were from Justice Douglas. Just one sentence. When a species is gone, it is gone forever. Nature's genetic chain, billions of years in the making, is broken for all time. Conserve water, conserve land, conserve life. And then he went on to speculate about what might be lost with any individual species, what potential it might have had. Could it cure cancer? Could it, you know, who knows if we lose these species? So Congress, 50 years ago, in a very different time, in a very bipartisan way, passed the Endangered Species Act. Now, today we have before us yet another missed opportunity. I'm not going to look at the Endangered Species Act and say it's perfect. It isn't. I believe, you know, 50-year-old law could use some revision. You know, we could assure greater transparency in ways that weren't considered and won't be proposed here today. We could promote better the use of best science. We could improve cooperation and coordination with the states who are committed to species protection and recovery. However, none of the legislation before us will do that. It will do nothing to improve species recovery, It'll do nothing to improve the science underlying listing decisions. Instead, actually, contravening what the Republicans espouse to wish, these bills will instead increase the amount of red tape that's involved, create more reporting requirements, divert agency resources from recovery efforts, and most oddly, and I think perhaps the oddest and most objectionable and nonsensical part of this legislation, is it will deem that any data submitted by any Native American tribe, any city, county, or state, will be deemed to the best available science. Now, if you have counties, you know, there's 16,000 counties in America. Let's say, you know, a couple of them come to a different conclusion. Well, suddenly the agency is confronted with, we have best available science from this county, we have best available science from this county, we have best available science from this county. Wow, haven't we created an unbelievable potential for litigation over any decisions that are made given that mandate? I think we have. Of course, that may be why they go on later in the bill to limit attorneys' fees, because they're anticipating that there'll be a huge proliferation of litigation, and they want to mitigate the costs of the problem that they're going to create with this nonsensical, this is the best available science. You know, so I think it's going to create a lot of tension, potentially between states and counties and rural counties and urban counties, and, you know, because they're all vying to submit the best available science.
That was Oregon Representative Peter DeFazio speaking on the U.S. House floor today on the need to preserve the Endangered Species Act.
Clackamas County commissioners have found themselves in conflict with a conservation group in deciding how to go about working with the state legislature to get more industrial land for business expansion. According to the Oregonian, commissioners started talking about a timeline for those issues stretching back to December of this year. That's when the commission wants to make its proposal to state legislators. Back in February, the legislature unanimously approved House Bill 4078 that would expand the urban growth boundary and set urban and rural reserves in Washington County. This move was prompted by the Oregon Court of Appeals, which threw out an earlier plan for setting up those reserves. Clackamas commissioners want to make sure their ability to expand their urban growth boundary is there in future years. The current issue around land use and timber sales involves an offer by the Western Rivers Conservancy to buy 140 acres of the land that the county planned to log as part of its forest management plan. The sale includes a price for the land and the timber and promises to generate 3 years of revenue for Clackamas County. But it's raised concerns over some residents over environmental issues and aesthetics. The conservancy, which the Oregonian called a pass-through for the Bureau of Land Management, wants to buy the land, and with the money, then the county can look for other land to harvest. This would alleviate many of the concerns of the current residents. And commissioners must decide whether to log the whole portion, whether to sell the 140 acres at a lower price than the staff recommends, or scrap the timber sale altogether.
A bill was introduced in the U.S. Senate today that would scale back surveillance powers of the National Security Agency, among other changes enacted by the USA Patriot Act. The USA Freedom Act, introduced by Vermont Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy, would also provide for greater transparency to prevent abuse of individual personal information. The bill would also create a public advocate to represent privacy concerns in the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance, or FISA, court. The measure, Senate Bill 1599, was introduced back in October. It has since worked its way through the congressional process and is now in committee. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden has been a champion for reduced government surveillance by intelligence agencies on American citizens. He and Colorado Democratic Senator Mark Udall praised Leahy's measure, although in the congressional publication, The Hill, both lawmakers said they did not think it did enough to protect U.S. citizens from being spied on through a foreign intelligence authority. Wyden and Udall noted that the USA Freedom Act did not address CIA, FBI, or NSA warrantless searches of the communications of Americans. Both senators promised to work to include those limits in Leahy's bill. The relationship between Congress and the U.S. surveillance agencies has been strained since Senate Intelligence Committee Chairwoman California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein discovered that an internal report about CIA activities, which was stored in congressional computers, had been hacked by the intelligence agency. Months of reclamations followed, and the congressional report released in March only seemed to fuel the spat. The 6,200-page investigation, which examined CIA operations, prompted members of the agency and the congressional staffers to go through it line by line to determine what were and were not classified disclosures. While intelligence officials say their surveillance programs are only aimed at foreigners abroad, privacy advocates warn it would be used to skirt Fourth Amendment protections and target U.S. citizens.
Foster youth in Oregon say they need more resources, more guidance, and greater consistency from the foster care system. They've shared a new set of recommendations and some potential solutions with Oregon policymakers. For more on this story, we turn to KBOO's Sequoyna Wright in conjunction with the Oregon News Service.
This week, copies of the new Oregon Bill of Rights for foster children are being sent to every foster home and group home and given to foster children and the people who work with them. Now, the same team of kids who developed it is making new recommendations to policymakers. They address concerns that teens aging out of foster care need more financial guidance and housing options to live on their own, and that foster children could be better matched with families to avoid bouncing from one home to another. In Royce Markley's childhood, it was 9 foster homes.
It's horrible for it, your sense of belonging. It creates all these emotional and developmental problems when you're moving all the time because you never have any time to focus on yourself. You're constantly focusing on the next move. Am I going to be moved? Am I going to have to make new friends? You're kind of in this defense mode all the time.
Markley and other members of the Oregon Foster Youth Connection are recommending a compatibility survey for foster parents and kids prior to assigning placements, and more funding for independent living programs in every county that help foster teens transition to adult living, but now serve only half of those who need the assistance. The recommendations were presented at a conference last week. They were practical and, in some cases, blunt about overloaded caseworkers and a system the kids say is inconsistent and lacks accountability. Pamela Butler, Oregon Foster Youth Connection Director, says the focus isn't on complaining, but on fixing things.
The recommendations they're making, they believe, will help kids right now in foster care, not larger, high-level policy discussions where we talk about change happening in a decade. These youth are talking about things that right now on the ground aren't going well, and sometimes wouldn't even take a law change to make that better for foster youth.
She points out that prior year's recommendations created the new hotline for foster youth in Oregon. The team will hone its new recommendations to present to the legislature next year. Perhaps the most poignant concern raised by foster youth is that they're, quote, seen as statistics rather than individuals, unquote. Now age 20, Royce Markley says that was his impression too.
Oftentimes I just felt like I was floating along and that most people just kind of agreed to the consensus that, you know, they're good kids, but they're not really going to amount to anything because statistics show that foster youth just really don't go anywhere in life.
Markley is working and in college now and says he aims to prove them wrong. For KBOO Evening News, in conjunction with Oregon News Service, I'm Sequoyna Wright.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with former British Shadow Foreign Secretary Gerald Kaufman about the massacre and genocide in Gaza. This will be followed by Out Loud at 6. Tonight's Out Loud welcomes Peter for Basic Rights Oregon and Samuel for Portland Queer Music Festival to discuss upcoming events from both organizations. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's Hard Knock Radio welcomes co-founder of the Black Panther Party and member Bobby Seale on the history of the organization during the racial tensions in cities like Oakland, California. Tomorrow's weather is mostly sunny with a high of 81 and a night low of 61 degrees and mostly clear skies. In today's Radcast, the only citizen-led radiation count on the air, radiation levels for today are 33 counts per minute in North Portland, 29 counts per minute in Vancouver, Washington. Eugene, Oregon has a count of 33 CPM, and Hanford, Washington has a count of 30 CPM. Counts per minute is a measurement of ionizing radiation, events registered by an instrument known as a Geiger counter. Radcast alert levels start at 100 CPM. More information can be found at radcast.org. Today in history, in 1895, Josephine St. Pierre Ruffin helped in the founding of the first National Convention of Black Women in Boston, Massachusetts. This also led to a successful monthly publication called The Woman's Era. Also on this day, on July 29th, 362, Greek philosopher and Roman Emperor Julian the Apostate ends education laws of his time. The quote of the day is by George Bernard Shaw. If history repeats itself and the unexpected always happens, how incapable must man be of learning from experience?
The time is 5:20. It's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower. And now we go to Jim Hightower for daily commentary.
Did you scramble to get your taxes done this year, dashing to the mailbox at the last minute? Yeah, me too. I really don't mind paying what I owe, but I hate having to pay the taxes owed by the likes of J.P. Morgan Chase, Mitt Romney, Exxon, and Amazon. They're just a few of the astonishingly profitable corporations and super-rich financial hucksters who walk their tax tabs each year, thus putting the cost of everything from the military to our national parks onto our shoulders. We constantly hear CEOs and their congressional hirelings wail about the punishing tax rate of 35% assessed on corporate profits. But they're grinning as they're crying, for they know they actually pay nowhere near that. In fact, the latest assessment by the Government Accountability Office found that U.S. corporations pay an average tax rate of only 12.6%, forcing workaday taxpayers to cover the multiple billions of dollars that these privileged elites dodge. How do they do that? Simple. They duck through ridiculous loopholes in our tax laws. How ridiculous? Try the subsidy for corporate criminals. If you get a speeding ticket, do you get to deduct the fine from the income tax you owe? Ha, just try it. But J.P. Morgan Chase was fined more than $20 billion last year for major frauds and consumer ripoffs, and his honchos have now deducted that punishment from the corporate tax bill, claiming it as a cost of doing business. Oh, they also get to deduct the many millions of dollars they paid lawyers to defend their blatant wrongdoing. This is Jim Hightower saying, well, sniff the elites, we're merely making rightful use of the deductions allowed by tax laws. But it's their lawyers who wrote those laws to legalize their thievery. And need I mention that they also get a deduction for the mega salaries and expenses of those lawyers? So we pay for their wrongdoings, their fines, and their lawyers.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. Detroit's bankruptcy trial begins August 14th. Detroit retired and active city workers voted to accept pension cuts of 4.5% plus loss of cost of living increases, because even heavier cuts were possible if they voted against these cuts. Their pensions average $19,000 to $20,000 a year. Police and firefighters voted to accept losing part of their pension cost of living raises. Police and fire pensions in Detroit average $32,000 a year.
The federal bankruptcy seeks to eliminate or drastically cut $18 billion in debt. The pension cuts are being forced on Detroit workers, even though the state constitution says that public worker pensions can't be cut. The federal bankruptcy judge ruled that federal bankruptcy law trumps that state pensions cut prohibition. Michigan's attorney general has publicly said he disagrees with the judge's ruling, but he's not using his office to legally challenge the ruling. U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin agrees with the AFGE, the union representing frontline Veterans Affairs caregivers, that staffing shortages are a big reason why so many veterans have such long waits for health care. Senator Baldwin has introduced a bill to increase VA staffing.
The reason for the long waits is that the VA in some areas is woefully understaffed. There are not enough physicians and other health care providers for the very significant needs that our veterans present today. The bill that I've introduced tries to essentially leverage greater health care availability in the VA by permitting the veterans' health services to hire more medical residents.
The Medicare Trust Fund is solvent until 2030, 4 years longer than was projected last year. The trustees' report released Monday cited the Affordable Care Act and its various cost savings reforms as a major contributing factor to the longer solvency for Medicare. The report says the health care law known as Obamacare included provisions aimed at reducing costs, increasing revenues, and combating fraud and abuse. A new study published in the New England Journal of Medicine estimates that over 10 million adults gained health insurance due to the Affordable Care Act. States that expanded Medicaid under the health care reform law saw significant coverage gains for low-income people 18 to 64 years old. The study found similar results to one by Gallup and the estimates from the Congressional Budget Office.
Workers Independent News is brought to you with support from union-owned, union-represented Bank of Labor. Bank of Labor has provided trust and fiduciary services to labor organizations for nearly a century. Online at bankoflabor.com.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Today, the U.S. Court of Appeals unanimously upheld the authority of the Department of Agriculture to require country of origin labeling on food. Consumer groups have hailed the decision as a victory for consumer rights in the U.S. KBOO's Henry Leisha spoke with a representative from Food and Water Watch for more information on the decision.
We're speaking with Patrick Woodall of Food and Water Watch about the U.S. Court of Appeals decision on country of origin labeling. Are you there, Patrick?
I absolutely am.
So first, what is the country of origin labeling law?
Country of origin labeling is a food label that was instituted in the 2008 Farm Bill that requires meat and poultry products to bear the origin of the animals that are in the food. So it has to have a born, raised, and slaughtered label. So if the animal was born, raised, and slaughtered in the U.S., it would say that. If it was an animal that came from Canada and was slaughtered here, it would say born in Canada, raised, and slaughtered in the U.S. And if it was born and raised in Mexico but slaughtered here, it would say that on the label. This is a very common sense consumer label that tells families where their food that they eat comes from. There's widespread consumer support for this. Over 95% of Americans support it. And American farmers really want country of origin labeling as well because they're proud of the food that they put on Americans' plates every day.
Who have the recent opponents of this labeling been? Who brought it to the appeals court?
Well, the American Meat Institute was the lead plaintiff, and they argued that there was no reason for consumers to actually want this information, that it was actually about what they called idle curiosity. But the reality is that consumers want this. There are good, substantial reasons for them to want this. The meatpackers basically want to conceal this information from the public. They want to be able to buy any livestock they want. They want to push down the prices that farmers receive and conceal the information from consumers, basically in a world where they encourage they discourage consumers from knowing what's on their plate, and this gives them leverage over farmers, and it gives them leverage over consumers. Even though consumers really want this information, the meatpackers don't think that consumers have the right to it. And they contended that they had a First Amendment right to conceal this information from consumers. And the court ruled very sensibly that they did not have a kind of First Amendment right to deceive or to conceal information from consumers, and instead upheld the USDA rules that provide this information.
So what does this mean for the Department of Agriculture? How will they be kind of controlling the labeling?
This labeling issue has been ongoing for quite a while, and consumers and farmers have fought for decades to actually get this exact kind of label into the supermarkets. What the ruling today says is that USDA has the authority to issue the very regs that consumers and farmers want, and this will enforce and continue enforcing the rule that has been in place since May of 2013.
We've been speaking with Patrick Woodall of the organization Food and Water Watch about today's U.S. Court of Appeals decision to uphold the U.S. Department of Agriculture's authority to issue rules concerning the country of origin labeling law. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been great to be here. Thank you.
For KBOO News, I'm Henry Leisha.
As the situation in Gaza worsens, foreign journalists are leaving the Strip by the busload. Bombs on Tuesday have targeted several media agencies and journalists' homes. Mohammed Omar, the award-winning journalist from Rafah, reported that on Tuesday, following the single worst night of Israeli bombardment, he saw buses full of foreign journalists leaving Gaza. We are joined on the line by Mohammed Omar from Rafah. Mohammed, can you tell us the situation now in Gaza?
Well, I'm in Gaza City at the moment. The Israeli F-16s are still hovering at the moment over the Gaza Strip. Several people were injured and killed in the last few hours. The number have already passed, already 110 people who were killed today. By this, we have about more than 1,200 who were killed and 7,000 injured. According to the United Nations, most of those people who are injured are civilians. Gaza City and the northern part of the Gaza Strip, there is no electricity, and that's because this morning F-16 missiles hit the Gaza main power plant, destroying it completely. As the station is still, until this moment, burning. As we speak, there's also a shortage of water, medical supplies, and a lot of growing humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Wow. And with that electricity going out, do you feel that Israel was particularly targeting the power plant in order to cut off the Palestinian electricity grid?
Assuming that Israel is the fourth military power in the world, I would expect they know what they are hitting. Certainly, yes, because they've bombed it the day before yesterday, and it was they knew that this is where it was located. In 2006, they bombed it, so it's not random. It's for sure to make Gaza live misery life and to cut the electricity on the Gaza Strip. Now, well, Gaza is feeling isolated now because of the shortages of electricity, and also when you don't have electricity, you also don't have water, which is a big concern for the big population in Gaza. 1.8 million are living here and struggling to survive under the Israeli siege.
And I understand that the water treatment facilities have also been targeted, which has impacted the access to water.
The first two stations that were targeted were next to Al-Makdousi in the northern part of Gaza City, and then another one to the Al-Zaytun area. and more of those areas have targeted more areas. Now, just last week, the water authorities, they've declared that 900,000, which is half of the population in Gaza, do not have access to water. Now, this is last week. There was electricity, but this week there is no electricity today. So I would say that the majority of people in Gaza, they don't have access, except those people who can afford generators. And even if you have a generator, and you will not have access to the water because the water stations need electricity in order to function. We are expecting other humanitarian crises because the sewage is not going to be flooding into outside of people's homes, which is going to be a humanitarian crisis, and also, sorry, environmental crisis, which is going to happen in the next few days if there is no electricity.
Well, and I know that your phone is running out. There is no electricity, and I don't want you to run out of battery in this situation because it is an emergency. But I just want to ask you about the targeting of journalists. Do you feel that this has gone on today, particularly as an effort to try and prevent word from the ground to getting out to the outside world?
It's a form of intimidation, if you like. Right after this targeting journalists, I see a bus today that left the Gaza Strip of international journalists. And when we reach this level, I get quite concerned that if journalists are not feeling safe, they feel that the local journalists have been a target, then it's a sign for international journalists to leave Gaza Strip. Not all of them, but a lot of them, they have left this morning. Israel wants them to leave. It's quite obvious because it's of Israel's interest to silence the truth and not to get the message out. So the targeting journalists, it can't be explained otherwise because Al-Shuruq building is known to be the home of several international and local TV channels, and also other buildings were targeted. So there is no doubt about that. In addition to Al Jazeera a few days ago, where they have been shot at by Israeli helicopters.
Well, and people around the world have become really dependent on Twitter feeds like yours. People can find Mohammed Omar at Mo Gaza on Twitter. But then with the cell phone coverage being sparse and the fact that electricity is going, do you feel that this is a possibility that we as people in the outside world would lose access to those feeds as well?
Unfortunately, yeah.
And this has been the worst day so far. We've heard the worst day and night. Does what is happening now seem to indicate that there is a move towards ceasefire, or does it seem like it's going to get worse?
It's going to get worse. There's already, as I'm speaking to you, I hear the ambulance sirens in the background, and I hear also they're surely shelling in the east of Gaza City. I also hear the warships bombing in the west of Gaza City. And we hear right now the Israeli F-16s and the drones are hovering at the moment. So it's not any quietness, not any ceasefire. The situation in Gaza is deteriorating as always. Last night I was particularly intense and was indeed the most terrifying night for me. Even I have survived a lot of wars and conflicts, but last night was by far the most terrifying night ever.
What made it the most terrifying? Was it the number of strikes?
Combinations of strikes, tank shells, and then you have the lighting flares, which basically when they fall in people's home, you don't know when they are going to fall. If they fall in people's home, they burn them. And then you get also the Israeli tanks, which is bombing everywhere. And you get also the constant attacks on medical crews and journalists. Then people start to say, well, if medical crews have been targets and journalists are targets, so who is not a target?
And we do know that over 200 children have also been killed, many of them small children, babies. We've seen some pretty horrific pictures coming out of Gaza. Mohammed, I want to let you go because I want you to be able to save some cell phone battery for emergencies. I've been speaking with Mohammed Omar. He is a journalist in Gaza, reporting right now from Gaza City. Thank you so much for joining us, Mohammed.
You're welcome.
And again, you can find Mohammed on Twitter at MoGaza. This is Jinka Soderberg with KBOO News.
And now the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Tuesday, July 29th, 2014. Palestinians were killed as Israel war on Gaza continues for the 22nd day. Meanwhile, in the West Bank, a youth dies of wounds after being shot by Israeli troops. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned.
On Tuesday evening, new Israeli airstrikes in Rafah killed two and wounded three. Also this evening, Palestinian medical sources in the Gaza Strip have reported that more than 22 Palestinians have been killed and dozens injured in recent Israeli airstrikes and bombardment in different parts of the Gaza Strip. The Israeli army also fired a missile into a UN car, killing a Palestinian doctor and his brother. Moreover, the Israeli army continued its illegitimate bombardment of Palestinian homes and civilian property and killed five family members of a Palestinian journalist, including two children in Gaza City. The death toll on Tuesday alone is over 100 killed and hundreds more injured. Most of those are still waiting to be identified. At least 1,216 Palestinians were killed and more than 7,000 injured due to the Israeli attacks on Gaza, which started on July 8th, the Palestinian Ministry of Health in Gaza reported. In the West Bank, a young Palestinian man died on Tuesday due to a serious injury suffered last week during clashes with Israeli soldiers invading in the town west of the southern West Bank city of Hebron. Alaa Jihad Azghayar, 21, suffered a serious injury a week ago after the army fired live rounds at Palestinian protesters at the entrance of Idna. He died of his wounds at Al Ahli Hospital in Hebron. Medical sources said that Azghayar was shot by a dum-dum bullet that expanded and explodes in the body upon impact. Thousands of Palestinians have been killed and seriously injured due to Israel's illegal use of mushroom and expanding bullets, including dum-dum bullets. Also near Hebron City on Tuesday, Israeli soldiers invaded Yatta and Beit Umar towns and clashed with local youth protesting Israeli war in Gaza. A number of youth were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation while soldiers kidnapped one protester. Elsewhere, Israeli settlers set fire on Tuesday to olive trees owned by Palestinian farmers from the village of Taqwa near the southern West Bank city of Bethlehem. Farmers say that they have been the target of settlers' attacks who want the land to expand their illegal settlements. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News.
Yeah, today, President Obama announced his decision to impose harsher sanctions on Russia. The sanctions align with a series of measures that the European Union implemented to penalize Russian support of separatists in the Ukraine. The U.S. sanctions are directed at several Russian banks and a large defense firm. European Union penalties prevent new arms sales to Russia and technology sales to Russia's oil industry. President Obama's decision to impose sanctions has been driven in large part by Russia's apparent unwillingness to cooperate with the investigators of the shooting down of Malaysia Flight 17. The actions on both sides of the Atlantic were coordinated to demonstrate solidarity against Russian involvement in the Ukraine conflict.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Henry Leisha, Emily Young, and Don Merrill. The producer and engineer is Sequoia Wright. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews or look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Emily Young.
And I'm Jenka Soderberg. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Linda Olsen Osterland hosts Wednesday Talk Radio, talking about the war in Afghanistan. At 9, on Law and Disorder, the international legal experts discuss two laws under the Geneva Conventions in relation to Gaza, one being that all attacks have to distinguish between military and civilian objectives, and you can't just kill civilians who aren't participating in war. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines and commentary with Chris Andre. 10:15, Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, it's The Recovery Zone with host Stephanie Potter. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth with British Parliament member Albert Kaufman speaking about Gaza. Good night, Emily.
Good night, Jenka.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
And I'm joined on the line now by the former Shadow Foreign Secretary, Gerald Kaufman. Hi, Gerald, and welcome to Dialect.
Good evening.
Can you just tell us a little bit about your background? Because I know you're Jewish, aren't you? And you have an interest in what goes on in the Middle East.
I've been interested in what goes on in the Middle East for more than 50 years. I took a very great interest in the foundation of the State of Israel, and I was a supporter of the State of Israel. I was brought up to be a religious Jew, and for years I supported Israel. What went wrong was when, after the war of 1967, when Israel conquered the Palestinian territories, instead of allowing the Palestinians to govern themselves, as the Israelis do, they suppressed them, occupied them, planted settlements in them, had hundreds of checkpoints. And that is both on the West Bank, including East Jerusalem, and also, of course, Gaza, which is the subject of the world's attention now.
I wonder if you could just take us a bit through that history. For many people, they don't know anything about, really, the 1950s, the 1960s and 70s. Can you just tell us what some of the main events have been over the years in Israel? Because, obviously, after World War II, people around the world did feel that it was very important that there was a homeland for the Jewish people who'd been so persecuted.
Yes, that's certainly true. The problem is that after Israel won what was called the Six-Day War in June 1967, they conquered all of the whole of the Palestinian territories. Up till then, what had been Palestine, created as a British mandate after the First World War, what had been Palestine had been divided, with the western part Israel and the eastern part part of the Kingdom of Jordan. Then, when in 1967 the Arab countries surrounding Israel went to war with Israel. Israel won that war. It's the last war that it won decisively. Israel won that war and occupied the Palestinian territories. And the problem, both for the Palestinians and for the Israelis, that the Israelis have never known what to do about it.
If you were in a position now, obviously you were at one time, I think for several years actually, Shadow Foreign Secretary. If you were in the boots now of the Foreign Secretary, Philip Hammond, what would you be saying and doing in order to try and alleviate the current problem? Because it does seem to be, and I don't know what your thoughts are on this, Gerald, but it does seem to be rather one-sided, with a very, very well-equipped army with the most modern weapons, really fighting what is effectively a kind of guerrilla army with very old-fashioned weapons that don't really seem to stand much of a chance. It doesn't really seem to be an equal fight.
I'm not excusing what Hamas does, but let's remember that this is not only Gaza. The gaze of the world is on Gaza now, but there's the whole of the West Bank in which the people don't have the right to govern themselves, aren't allowed to move freely in Jerusalem, have their homes taken away from them by settlers, with the Israeli army and police supporting the settlers. The Israelis have built a wall which is illegal and keeps the Palestinians away from their own land. They have, as I say, hundreds of checkpoints, which means that the Palestinians can't move freely. 500,000 Jews are living in settlements on Palestinian land, and that's in the West Bank. So don't let's forget that. What we've got now is a situation in Gaza which the Israelis have blockaded for many years, so that the people in Gaza have very little fresh water, have very little food, rely on the United Nations for food, for 80%, something like that. They don't have fuel. The Israelis have just attacked and very seriously damaged the only power station in Gaza. The Israelis are behaving not only monstrously and criminally, they're idiots, because they cannot win this war. They've tried twice before to conquer Gaza and to stop Hamas doing what it does. They can't do it. They don't understand, which eventually the British government understood in Northern Ireland, that you can't defeat guerrilla warfare. All you can do is do a political settlement, which sensible British governments did in the end. But the Israelis are too stupid as well as too callous to understand that.
As someone who was a shadow foreign secretary, what sort of pressure do you think that the Foreign Office now could be putting on to bring about some kind of peace, Gerald?
Look, we're going to get nowhere on this situation until the only power that's got the power to force Israel to do something, namely the American government, says to the Israelis, enough is enough. The Americans support Israel. Kerry, their Secretary of State, has said that again today. But supporting Israel doesn't mean condoning everything they do. Kerry spent months and months and months trying to get a negotiated settlement, but the Israelis don't want it. They believe that their huge military power can prevail. But it may prevail, but it doesn't save them. Yesterday, 10 Israeli soldiers were killed. They don't like that. And of course, they're right not to like it. They cherish their lives. But the Israelis have killed 20 times as many people in Gaza as they have lost themselves. And the latest news is that in one of the latest attacks, the Israelis have actually killed United Nations representatives in Gaza. They're idiots. They can't win. As I said in the House of Commons last week, they can kill, but they can't win.
So what pressure, diplomatic pressure, can Britain put on? I understand, obviously, that America is much more powerful diplomatically, but surely Britain, who helped create the State of Israel in the first place through the Balfour Declaration and other things, Gerald, surely we could be putting some pressure on too to bring about peace.
The British government is useless on this issue, utterly and totally useless. The previous Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said the right things, though he did nothing. Cameron, last week in the House of Commons, basically gave the Israelis a blank check. And it's stupid to do that, because it's in the Israelis' interests to have a settlement. It's in the Israelis' interest for them to have peace. But they've now killed, yesterday and today, they've killed another 100 people in Gaza, including, as I say, United Nations representatives. This is a problem without a solution as long as the Israelis believe that their military power can win. But it can't. They've not won a war since 1967. They've invaded Lebanon several times and come out with their tails between their legs. And that's why I say they're harsh and vicious, and they've committed war crimes, but above all, they're fools.
Are there divisions opening up between different factions of Jewish people over this, Gerald?
I think that a lot of Jewish people are ashamed of what the Israeli government are doing. I get letters and emails from Jewish people, and not just in this country, saying that it's essential that there should be a settlement. One thing I will not have, and I made this clear, the Israeli government may speak for the people of Israel, but they do not speak for the Jewish people outside Israel.
Hello, Gerald. This is Mehrnaz Shahabi. I'm a peace and justice activist from Iran, living in Britain. Firstly, I must say that I'm honored to be in the same program as you. You have been a source of hope and inspiration for us all in the anti-war movement with your compassion and integrity in relation to the issue of Israel. One question I wanted to ask is that, is the policy of British government towards Israel. Does the British government has its own agenda because of the power of the Israel lobby in Britain and any interests that Britain might have? Or is it just blindly following the United States?
Well, it's very nice of you to say what you've said. The real problem is this, that Jewish organizations in the United States, even though they're losing their full pressure, blackmail politicians by reminding them of the Holocaust. And of course, the killing of 6 million Jews by the Nazis was one of the most terrible crimes in human history. But it does not excuse what the Israelis are doing. Most of my family were killed by the Nazis. My parents were immigrants who came to England. But most of my family remained in Poland and were murdered by the Nazis. And my grandmother was shot dead in her bed by a Nazi soldier. So I'm very well aware of what the Holocaust is all about. But as I've said, my grandmother did not die in order to provide cover for Israeli soldiers murdering Palestinian grandmothers.
Is there any hope for the Middle East? Because we do seem to come across these kinds of massacres, very difficult situations, wars going on time and time again. Is there any real solution? And if so, what do you think it would be?
I don't see a solution. It's a long time since I saw a solution. Some American presidents, Clinton, Carter, George H.W. Bush, the father of the previous President George W. Bush, all made efforts to try to bring peace about. Barack Obama hasn't lifted a finger to do this. He's a big windbag and he talks a lot, but he doesn't do anything. And in the end, the only way in which the Israelis can be made to see sense is if the United States withdraws its economic help and withdraws its armaments that it supplies to Israel. But the United States is not going to do that. So we don't have a neat and tidy solution. My own view is that the day will come when the Palestinian people will say, we're dying anyhow, large numbers of us are dying, so let's die for something. There have already been two uprisings against Israel by the Palestinians, what they call the Intifadas. If there's another one, it will be on a far, far bigger scale, and the Israelis will not know what hit them. There's no point in pretending that you can have a settlement without Israel being made to negotiate. The day may come when they stop being stupid and learn to be practical. But meanwhile, we're living through this awful episode, which will come to an end eventually, but it won't be the last. This is the third Israeli attack on Gaza, and they failed twice before, and they'll fail now. But they'll kill a lot of people on the way.
Thank you very much, Gerald. It's been an honor to speak to you.
Thank you.
KLU Community Radio and Triangle Productions are proud to co-sponsor the return of Medicarefully Fabulous. Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th, Medicarefully Fabulous will return to the Sanctuary Theater for a limited engagement. The show is a series of original stories about aging, faith, friendships, and recovery. Again, that's Medicarefully Fabulous, Friday, August 8th through Saturday, August 16th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at KLU.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And they'll be
the
mine.
Time?
All mine.
The time is 6:01. Coming up next is KBOO's Queer Culture Radio Show, Out Loud. Stay tuned. They've got some amazing guests coming up live in the studio.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation.